Hey friends, happy April to you. This is not an April Fool's joke at all. In the last one, I did mention that I would be giving away a $35 Bagpipe Swag gift card. So real quick, I'm doing that right now. That's going to go to Benjamin Elzerman for sharing a favorite episode of the Droning On podcast and tagging us. I appreciate it very much, Ben. Ben and I have interacted a bit. He's got some really, really cool bagpipe-related 3D print projects. So if you don't follow him on social media already, I dare say it's worth it, especially if you're interested in that kind of stuff. Very cool stuff. So Ben, I'll be reaching out to you with a gift card for Bagpipe Swag. Probably by the time this episode goes out, actually, you'll probably already have an email or a social media message from me or something. But I hope you all enjoy this episode. I had a lot of fun talking to Jeff, and I'll get out of your way so you can enjoy it. Bye-bye. Have a good one. Bye.
Jeff, thanks for coming on the show, and I don't want you to feel at all stressed because it's not live, so I can edit anything later. So say whatever you want with reckless abandon. I know you like to cuss like a sailor, so, you know, just let loose.
it's a pleasure. Happy to be here.
Well, I appreciate it. And I think I've been bothering you about coming on the show for like maybe more than a year now. So it's nice of you to have been patient with me.
I apologize.
Oh, you don't need to apologize. No, I'm apologizing for bothering you over and over again for such a long time. I know you're a busy man.
Things have been a little bit busy, but you know, it's great. I being retired, it's so much, you know, it's kind of like I tell my wife, I should have retired 40 years ago, but you know, I find myself even more busy than when I was working.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. It's like when you move a reptile to a bigger cage, like they just grow to fill the space, right? So
that's right.
You've got more hours in the day, but stuff will come up to fill those hours, won't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, and not least among those, of course, is running the great Wuspaba. Now I don't want to make you feel old, Jeff.
Right.
But I've been piping here locally for 15 plus years, and I don't remember you ever not being there. You're a fixture of competition for me. So what's up with that? Like, how did this start for you, you know?
Oh, it's actually a funny story. So I want to say we were at the old Santa Rosa Games, and it was my first time to go. I went along with my buddy who's now my brother-in-law, Andrew Morrill.
Hey, that worked out.
Yeah. And so he was sitting on the music committee for WSPA at the time, and he said, you know, I've got this meeting I have to attend, so I'll just run in. You sit over here on this bench in the lobby, wait for me, and then we'll take off right after. So I sat on the bench, and maybe 15 minutes later, Andrew comes out with Susan Thornton, who was the president at the time, mm-hmm. from she's actually from Littleton, Colorado. She was the mayor of Littleton, Colorado at the time, during, you know, when they had the Columbine shootings.
Oh, man.
There. So
rough time, but to be the mayor of that town. My goodness.
Yeah, absolutely. But she came out and she said, I understand from Andrew that you know how to use a computer. And yeah. I thought, well, you know, I'm not the best on a computer, but yeah, I can turn it on. And she said, well, we need a registrar. We're starting to do solos.
It's now. Like, you can turn on a computer. Sir, you're hired.
Yeah, that's right. And so I remember she invited me into this meeting, and, you know, there was Bill Merriman and Margaret Craig was in there, and you know, some of these people that, you know, became giants in WSPA,
mm-hmm.
Were sitting in this meeting, and she just said, you know, just sit here and take notes. And so they were talking about, I had no idea what they were talking about. They were talking about MSRs, and I remember thinking, how do you spell that?
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
I was going E-M-M-E-S-S-E-R.
Right.
You know, and I had no idea. And so from there, it just kind of grew into, you know, where I'm, you know, where things are today. So.
Were you going to the Santa Rosa games, like, just for fun then? Like, had you been into it already? Like,
no, not at all. When I was 17, Andrew and I started playing around with a practice chanter.
Yeah.
But nothing serious. And so, you know, it was just kind of like a vacation for me to get away.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Man, that's amazing.
Baptism by fire, right?
Right, yeah. You don't usually go straight from kind of like vaguely aware of Highland Games to the registrar for, you yeah. know, organizing competitions. That's, usually you that's have how... to... You have to really love it a lot first before you're willing to do that kind of thing, usually.
That's how desperate they were, right?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, man, that's interesting, though. Like, I've talked with Kevin, you know Kevin Saunders, but I've talked yeah. with him a little bit before about how I've been in this, maybe kind of stuck in this mindset before where I just kind of assumed that on a band level as well as on a, you know, association level too, like it would be unthinkable that people who don't play would have any interest in helping in like leadership roles, you know?
Right.
Which is so silly of me. Like what Kevin pointed out for me is like, no, look at like these big bands, you know, the big grade one bands and stuff like that. Like the players that you see on the green are the tip of the iceberg. There's such a massive support team behind those people, you know?
Right. Exactly.
And I think sometimes that's limited, like when setting up Garden Valley and stuff like that, that's maybe limited a little bit, like how far we cast the net when looking for people to like be on the board or to help with parades, you know, stuff like that. It kind of, we feel like, oh, well, amongst the pipers and drummers, who's willing to do this thing? And we kind of forget right. to even check outside of that small circle, you know?
Absolutely. And, you know, the greatest, one of the greatest things that I feel and kind of has been my go-to has been trying to get more and more people involved because you never know, you know, what can spring out of, you know, some people and maybe their sons or daughters that become incredible players.
Yeah,
And, you know.
That's a good point. Yeah, so, absolutely. Absolutely. I want to sing each life that touches ours for good, but insert right. bagpipe lyrics instead or something.
Right.
So then, Jeff, if like over these years, have you kept a tally of how many years you've spent like on WSPBA boards?
Well, you know, I started in 1996.
Yeah.
And I've basically... You know, there might be 1 or 2 years where I took a break.
Yeah.
I needed a bit of a break, but it's been fairly steady since then.
Well, just not, again, not to make you feel old or anything, Jeff, but
right.
96 was when I was in kindergarten. Okay. And so like, that's when you started and it was, you know, somewhat, let's see, 8-9 years later that I first picked up a practice chanter. And that's why for me, you are a fixture of bagpiping. You were already there, you know, and you have always been there, you know,
James, I could be your grandpa.
How's that? Weird. That's impossible. None of my grandpas were nearly as cool as you. I can say that because one of them has already passed on and the other one is so drunk all the time. He wouldn't even know if he heard it. So I can go ahead and say something like that wantonly and not be too worried about any wrathful visits on Sunday at dinner time, you know, or anything like that.
Right.
Well, then Jeff, why, like, I had in my head that you were a drummer. Have you picked up drums along the way, or is that just something I invented?
You know, I started out as a tenor drummer, mm-hmm. and I was with the Utah Pipe Band. Mm. During that time, I took some lessons from David Barclay.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And, you know, that was amazing. That is and will always be a special bit of history for me. Mm-hmm. But BJ Gunn was working with me on tenor, mm-hmm. and I actually went out to two or three competitions playing tenor drum.
Yeah.
And then, of course, as you well know, there's this kind of interplay between pipers and drummers. Mm-hmm. And Andrew was saying, hey, you got to come away from the dark side.
Yeah.
you know? And so that's when we started working on chanter type
right,
stuff.
Right, yeah. So how far have you, like, man, shoot, I don't even know, so I feel silly asking, but, like, how far have you taken pipes? Did you compete on pipes too?
Yeah. So, no. I have, you know, and to be truthfully honest, I am not a good piper.
Hey, me neither. Let's all be honest.
I can get them blown up. I can play a couple of tunes, but I am actively taking lessons. And so, currently I take from, Ross Morrill, which is Andrew's son.
Yeah.
And Bob Worrell.
And Bob Worrell, of all people. Yeah. My goodness, wow. Well, so there's one good way to fill up your retirement hours.
Well, those two keep me on my toes,
yeah.
I'll tell you.
That's so really cool. Now, Ross, of course, we have had on the show. I'll put a link to some interviews with him because it's fun to talk with Ross, both as a pipe maker and as, you know, a pipe major of a grade two band. But Bob Worrell, I have not yet convinced Bob Worrell to come on the show. We'll see if we can get him on here someday.
Bob is great.
And that'll be the main thing I talk to him about. Of all the things he's done in piping and in the piping scene, the main thing I'll ask him about is how you are as a pupil. That'll be the main topic of conversation.
And if you could see him, he'll just roll his eyes. You know.
So you started messing around with a practice chanter when you were young. Like, why did that happen? Did you have any family that were interested in piping and stuff like that? Like, or was it just that Andrew was like, hey, this would be fun, you know?
James,
like, anything there?
This is a wild story, and it's like my wife says, you know, she'll always say whenever I start into one of my stories, just give me the punchline. You know?
Well, that's not what this show is about. I want you to drone on. So go right on into it.
So when I was just a little kid and we would go to the 24th of July parade, I was just absolutely fascinated.
Which, let me just, real quick, for context for anybody outside of Utah, that's because the 24th of July is Utah's becoming a state holiday. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was just, I love bagpipes. And, you know, actually, as, you know, as I grew up, it kind of developed into even just any kind of Celtic music.
What pipe bands, do you know what pipe bands you would have been hearing when you were a kid? Would it have been just the Utah Pipe Band at that time?
Probably, you know, there was the Utah Pipe Band, the Salt Lake Scots.
Salt Lake Scots, of course, yeah.
And, you know, everybody was talking to me about Simon Fraser. Mm-hmm, so, mm-hmm. But we didn't have YouTube back then.
Right, right.
And then, of course, when I would attend, you know, some of these games later on, you know, you'd get to hear, you know, Kevin Blanford's, you know, R.P. Blanford and Son back then, and the City of Sacramento, and, you know, L.A. Scots, and,
yeah,
you know, all those kind of bands. But So I always just felt like somewhere I probably have some, you know, some Scottish blood or something. You know, that's the dream of all of us guys, right?
You discover the one genetic line.
Right.
Go straight to William Wallace.
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I got into a little bit of genealogy, and I was adopted, but...
I had no idea you were adopted.
Yeah, I was adopted.
Yeah.
So
more of a question mark for you, trying to figure out, like, oh, maybe this is something, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And so, you know, when I was doing my adoptive line genealogy, you know, we had to go back 7 generations to, you know, find a Campbell, you know.
But that one rings the right kind of bell, right?
Yeah, you know, so I'm going to cling on to that thing for dear life, you know. Yeah. And I guess it's going to be about 7 years ago, I finally got the bug for some reason to try to find out about my birth parents.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew where I had been adopted. It was through the Children's Service Society here in Salt Lake.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this sweet girl, Becky, I remember her first name, that said that she could help me. Because when I was 17, I tried to find, you know, I was going through my rebellious stage, yes, and you're not my real parents.
Totally,
and, you know,
yep.
You know, and so I was.
I don't even belong here. I'm leaving.
Right, yeah. Right. You know, and so I thought, you know, I'll try and find out who my real parents were. But back then, in the old days, you had to the records were all sealed,
mm-hmm.
and so you had to get a court order.
Mm.
And of course, being a dumb 17-year-old, I didn't know what I was, you know, what I was doing. So I just quickly gave up on that idea. But like I said, about 7 years ago, I decided to pursue it again. And Becky was there and she said, nope, laws have changed. You know, we can get the information for you. And so you know, we went through the paperwork and she said, while I was on the phone, she said, I have your record right here, which was really kind of scary.
Like she had all the,
I
can only imagine, of course, Jeff, but yeah, like I can, like to have it all there on one little sheet of paper, so much significant information all gathered together. I can imagine that would be, overwhelming.
And she said, is there anything that you want to know? Mm-hmm. You know, and of course, my first question was, well, is anybody still living?
Sure,
And then my second question was, you know, is there anything in there that might suggest that, you know, I have any kind of Scottish or Irish, you know, ancestry or anything like that?
Yeah.
And so she was going through there and said, well, you've got some brothers and sisters still living.
There's news, huh?
Yeah. And she said, oh, this is really interesting. She said, your grandparents are from Scotland.
No, really? So not even a distant connection.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
And they were born in Motherwell. They actually came over and and the story gets wild, but that was the connection.
We talk about the sound of bagpipes, you know, stirring something in our blood and stuff like that, you know. I sometimes get a bit cynical and think like, it's just a cool sound that, you know, some people are going to like and some people aren't going to like, and that's all there is to it. But that's special. I mean, that's a pretty darn cool thing for you to have, like, felt this connection to the music and for so many years continue feeling it, and then to find that there is a real connection and it's not a distant one either.
Well, James, and then it goes a little bit farther. I mean, it like I said, it just gets crazy weird. So I found out that I had a sister that was living down in St. George, and she had been adopted as well.
Yeah.
And so there was two of us that were given up for adoption. And when I connected with her, and we were doing the 40 questions kind of thing, you know.
Yeah, what is that first phone call like to be like, hello, my name's Jeff, I'm your brother, you know? Like,
right.
Man.
Well, I'll tell you, it was really interesting. Yeah. So my sister Natalie, we were sitting there talking, and I said, well, you know, what do you like? What do you do? You know?
Yeah.
And she played piano and organ like I do.
Yeah.
And she says, well, she says, this is kind of crazy. My brother plays the pipes and I Highland dance.
No way.
And I said, you gotta be kidding me.
Yeah.
You know? And I thought, how from a family where she had been, you know, given up for adoption.
Yeah.
How would she, you know, so then, you know, you wonder if there's some kind of predisposition to, you know, or some genetic thing.
Right,
you know?
Right. I mean, there's not enough individuals in this situation to put together like empirical evidence to find the connections, right? But it does make you wonder, because that's quite the coincidence.
Yeah, yeah, it was amazing.
Oh, man.
It was amazing.
That's super cool.
Yeah.
So like, have you... So does that mean that her adoptive brother also played pipes then?
Yes.
Wow. Yeah.
Yes.
But she did Highland dancing, huh?
Right.
And right down there, did she grow up in St. George?
She did.
So she was Highland dancing down there while you were picking up the chanter and tenor drumming and stuff up here. And,
right.
And all the while you didn't know. And did she?
Had
no
idea.
Do you know if she knew about your grandparents anytime before?
She did not.
She didn't even know, huh?
She didn't know until I told her.
Yeah, you cracked the info to her, too. So, man, wow.
Yeah.
That is so cool. Well,
amazing.
Anything else that I have to ask or say, Jeff, just feels like not nearly as cool now. I feel like we apexed here.
Well, I'll take it one step further.
Yeah.
I've been doing a little bit of composition.
Yeah.
And one of the tunes that I've recently written is called Finding My Home.
Mm.
And so it talks about this, you know, needing for this connection and that kind of thing.
Mm.
But at the end of the tune, it talks about an event that this is where it gets kind of weird. So my sister Natalie and I, we decided that we were going to try to find my grandparents' grave because they were buried in Salt Lake.
Oh, of course, because so, having come over here. Yeah, I was imagining that would have been in Scotland, but yeah, that makes sense. It would be close by.
Yeah. And so we went to, I think it's called Wasatch Lawn up on...
Oh, I know that one, yeah.
Highland Drive.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so
being in the bagpiping business, of course, we all know all the cemeteries, right?
Right. Absolutely. So we asked the sexton and they were able to locate the grave. And I'm thinking, you know, this is crazy because this is up in the area where my adoptive grandparents are buried.
Oh, like as you got closer and closer, it was feeling familiar?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
So Natalie and I are walking around and, you know, I'm going, oh, yeah, so this is where my grandparents on my mom's side is buried. And she goes, what was the name again? And I said, Stevenson. She goes, well, there's a Stevenson right here, which it was one row up. It was probably about as, you know, not even 4 or 5 feet. They're buried across from each other.
My goodness.
And they, of course, would have never known each other.
No, right.
And so, you know, makes it easy on Memorial Day, but holy how cow, convenient, that was, yeah. Yeah, right? but that just the wildest thing.
Jeff, you know? That is amazing. I mean, like, it's for you to make meaning of course. So it's not like I need to make meaning of it. I'm just saying, like, personally, I don't know what to make of this, but why is there a tear coming out of my eye? There's something, is it because it's cool, beautiful, magical? Like, there's just something special here. That's super cool.
That, it was amazing. It really was. I'll have to take you up there next time, James.
Absolutely, man. Absolutely.
We'll take a look.
It's something that maybe has been on anybody's mind. I don't know, but like I grew up, my best friends were adopted when I was growing up, and it was always funny that their parents would like slip into a very normal thing, I think, for any parent when, like, you know, if their kid liked a food that the parent didn't like, or if the kid was being, you know, rebellious or something like that, right? Being sassy, the parent would say something like, "Oh, he doesn't get it from my side of the family." And then they'd go, "Oh, of course he doesn't." You know, like, genuinely they would say that, you know. You know, and of course there were always these tropes that we would just, like, naturally assume. Like, one of my friends was adopted from India, and the other one was adopted here locally but was Native American. And, like, if Jared, who was from India, if he liked, like, spicy food, we would go, "Oh, well, it's because, you know, he's, like, predisposed somehow to, like, curry and stuff like that," you know?
Right.
Which maybe is just silly. Probably is just silly, right? But there, we had, like, these assumptions, like, just built into our brains, you know?
Right.
And like, a while ago, I talked to a really great Illan Piper named Liam Winnett, who was adopted from Texas and now lives in Ireland and picked up the Illan Pipes there. And I did ask him, I was like, "Have you ever, like, listened to, like, you know, some Texas country music and gone, like, ah, the sound of my people?" And he said he never has. So maybe it only goes one way, you know, maybe it only goes one way. But it's a similar thing where I think, like, now what if Jared really did have some sort of predisposition to really like spicy food because of something in genetics? I don't know. Maybe there is something there, you know. And what if there is something about the sound of bagpipes that would have driven people to pursue that sound and achieve it? And whatever that is genetically is still there for appreciation of that sound. I don't know.
And maybe not even just the sound, but, you know, the melodic line, you know, just the way, you know, when you're hearing Celtic music and how the music line kind of, you know, kind of rolls.
There is kind of a formula there, huh?
Right, yeah. Right.
I mean, that's why it's distillable as a genre, why it's recognizable. There are characteristics there.
Right.
Yeah, that is absolutely
interesting. So I'll tell you what's going on with this.
Yeah.
So I'm in a project that I'm working on right now. So Andrew Morrill and I have been talking about you think it's bad that it's taking you over a year to get me on the, you know, on the
we got podcast, longer timelines going.
Oh my gosh. Andrew and I have been working on our quote CD for probably 2 years now, you know.
I was going to say, like, since CDs were the main medium for music.
Right. And, you know, it's like, "Oh, we got to get this done. We got to get this done." And I said, yeah, we do. But there was a couple of tunes that I needed vocals for.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, when I called you, you said you weren't available, so, you know.
I'm known in the area as an excellent vocalist, and so I would have been an obvious choice.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, that's why I wanted you, but, and so, you know, I'm thinking, who can I get to do vocals? And we were in the recording studio, and our sound engineer, great guy, who used to work out of LA, he said, "You know, this music," and that was this particular tune that I was talking about, "Finding My Home."
Yeah.
He says, "You know, that really," he said, "you need to get like one of the Celtic women to, oh, see, you well, know, sure. to sing that.
Wouldn't that
oh,
be nice?
Oh, yes. Yeah. That's what I'll do.
Sure, yeah, I'll let me... if Enya's busy, I guess I'll call one of them, right?
Right. Let me just hop on the phone here.
Yeah.
You know, I went home and told my wife, and she just burst out laughing, you know. Yeah. We thought it was the greatest thing. And so the next day, there's this email that our sound engineer sent us, and it had, you know, this email link on it.
Oh, did he, like, have a connection?
Yeah, he had a connection.
Really? So he wasn't just throwing that out in the air. He actually had something of substance to...
Right.
Wow.
And so, you know, I was thinking, there's just no way I'm going to do that. Still.
Right, yeah.
You know, and then I thought, well, okay, you know, if I did send it, she would ignore me, number one. Number two, she'd say no. Or, I don't know. You
right,
know?
Tiny possibility, maybe, who knows.
So,
but what's the worst that could happen is what
yeah,
you're saying, right?
Yeah, yeah. So that's what I came down to.
Yeah.
What's the worst that can happen? So I sent off the email, and about 10 minutes later, I get this email back that says, could you send me the soundtrack?
What? Like she was sitting there waiting for your email, man.
Yeah, right.
What in the world?
And, you know, so I send her the soundtrack, and about 5 minutes later, she says, I'm in.
Whoa.
And I'm like, oh my gosh, this is incredible. So, I've been working with Alex Sharp, who sang with Celtic Women for a number of years. And she is here in Bountiful today.
Oh, really?
And we're going into the recording studio today.
Whoa.
And we were there yesterday for a few hours. And just... one of the most amazing, you know, I call it gobsmacked experiences I've ever had.
Yeah, that is so cool. I'll tell you what I'm waiting for now, Jeff, is for you to give us the reveal that then you found out that you and Alex are cousins.
Yeah. Well, you know, actually, it's kind of funny because my wife have been really hitting off well.
Yeah.
To the point where... You know, she'll come over for dinner or something, and then it's like, well, I might as well just leave the room because those two are, you know.
Yeah.
You know, just
you're just
chatting.
The third wheel.
Right, right, right.
Yeah, but go play your piano, Jeff.
Yeah, right? Right. Oh, man. But it's been amazing.
Man, that is super cool. Jeff, if there's any like timing benefit to releasing this episode in a way that like promotes the CD or something, you know, later on down the road, let me know.
Well, and I didn't want to make it sound like I was doing a plug.
Dude, do a plug though. That's super cool.
You know,
I was already going to ask you if I could play Highland Vamp at some point during this episode. So I was going to pull some of your music anyway.
Oh, anyway. Yeah.
And that's exactly why I wanted to play it.
Yeah.
I honestly do enjoy it. I do like that track. And for what it's worth, my wife likes it too. Like everybody who I've talked to so far is like, no, I like that. That's fun. You know, so.
So with Highland Vamp, it was kind of a let's get together and we're just kind of fooling around on the piano. And it was not serious at all.
I think that comes across. Like, it's definitely not a serious tune.
Oh, no, not at all. And matter of fact, it was like, you know, so let's just throw something together and see if we can even make sound.
Yeah.
And so we threw this thing together. I've it personally is my worst tune. But, you know, it's so funny because there's a lot of other people that really like it. And I'm just sitting there shaking my head going, yeah. How? Oh, you guys, no.
Energy of just fun collaborations, you know, comes through or something like that that gets us on some level that we don't quite recognize or something, because there is something about it. It's a fun tune.
Well, and I appreciate that. And, you know, that could very well be because, you know, you would have thought that we, you know, were drunk when we made the thing.
Yeah, I could see that, yeah.
Yeah, anyway.
So then Jeff, where does the piano come into your life? Because that's the thing. Like, you know, you and Andrew played small pipes and piano at Zach's funeral, which was lovely. And I know since my wife's aunt is, you know, goes to church with you there, I know that you guys have done stuff at church before because she's told me, you know.
Right.
And so, like, where did piano come into your life? And was it directly because of Celtic music, or did it kind of, you know, then become a thing you could blend with bagpipes and stuff like that?
Right. So I actually started when I was, I want to say I was 7.
Oh, pretty young. Huh?
I started playing organ.
Oh, you started on the organ, really?
Yeah, we started on the organ. We had this little Hammond organ.
Jeff, and, my desk that I'm sitting at right now to talk to you from is actually a Hammond organ.
Oh my goodness.
So carry on.
Yeah, that is awesome.
Yeah.
So, and my feet at the time didn't reach the pedals.
Yeah.
And so when I was trying to play the pedals, I do not know how many times I had to slip that bench kind of forward, mm-hmm. and inevitably it would slide out from underneath me and I'd fall flat on my butt, you know.
I was imagining just standing on the pedals, you just step from one to the other.
Oh, right. But yeah, so I started on organ, and I was living in Billings, Montana at the time. Mm. And then when we moved down to Salt Lake, there was a young man named Alexander Schreiner. He actually wasn't that young, but he was at the Tabernacle, and I started taking organ lessons from him. And then I switched, and I started taking lessons from Roy Darley, who also was one of the Tabernacle organists.
At the time, would the Tabernacle organ or the one at the Madeline have been sort of like the biggest organ in the state?
Yes.
One or the other?
Clearly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and it probably was the Tabernacle because, you know, it has so many ranks of pipes. And,
oh, yeah.
And the Madeline, you know, if I recall, I think the Madeline only has 3 or 4 keyboards compared to...
This is, you know, this is an organist for sure talking. Yeah. Only 3 or 4. Well,
yeah, you know, but yeah, it so I went on an LDS mission. I went up to Montreal, Canada, Quebec, and nice.
Did you learn French up there?
I did.
Nice.
I did. And then when I came back, I started piano.
And was was the focus of your organ playing from a young age, like churchy music, or did you pick up some like organ jazz along the way as well? Theater kind of music?
Yeah, no theater. It was all Bach.
Oh, yes.
And
classically trained, huh?
Classically trained type stuff. Yeah.
Have you ever been to the those organ guys loft? Were...
Yes.
Dude, there's a cool organ, huh?
That is a fun organ. And that's probably one of the best ones for playing, you know, your theater type stuff. And yeah.
When my wife and I were teenagers, when we were courting, that was one of our favorite dates, was to go to the organ loft. They'd have a guy sitting there playing the organ, and just, but just for the sake of the people listening, the organ loft, I think that this was a theater organ that like got saved in a chicken coop when the theater got knocked down or something. And like, basically at this point, it's now been like built into the walls of this building. So like, not only does this organ player have control of the organ pipes, but there are all kinds of like percussion things and bells and whistles that will go off throughout the entire building as they're playing, and you sit there and eat dinner while they play music for you, and then you dance, and you know, they'd have like a 3-piece or a 4-piece group get out and play music, and we'd all dance, and in my memory it was my wife and I and a ton of awesome retired couples like, you know, like World War II vets seeing how low I could go, you know, like challenging me to like boogie contests and stuff. It was a lot of fun though.
Yeah, I remember those days. Good old days.
Yeah. But I interrupted you. So then it was later on, after you got back from your mission and everything, that you started picking up piano, huh?
Right.
Did that feel easy? Because I'm usually, I feel like most people go from piano to organ, and so you're adding things, and you have to sustain with your fingers and stuff. Did it feel easy to go to piano in some ways?
It did, but the touch is so different, right? Mm-hmm. And so where, like you say, on the organ, you have to sustain the notes. What's the word?
There's a word for it, right? That crossover finger thing?
Where you, right.
Finger substitution? Is that what it's called?
Yeah, well, so you've got the finger substitution, but it's more of where you're kind of, I wouldn't call it plunking the keys, but you don't do that on the organ. You have to, it's all legato. You've got to, play it very smoothly and that kind of thing. So that was a bit of a challenge trying to, because on the piano, especially if you're on a nice, you know, big grand piano, the weight of your finger, when your finger comes down on the key, you can increase the richness of the tone by how hard you hit the key, right?
Not a thing with the organ.
Yeah, right, right.
Yeah. That's so interesting, Jeff, because like, I don't consider myself an expert in any way that like I would have been able to figure something out from watching, but I've watched you play piano a little bit, and it has struck, like, I like watching your hands when you play, and in some way it felt like, this is different. There's something unique going on there. And I'm not saying, like I say, I'm not an expert. It's not like I was like the one person who could have perceived this or something, right? Probably experts would have been able to look and say, this person clearly plays organ or something like that, right?
Yeah.
But it does make me, do you feel like maybe your piano playing is unique because of extensive organ training first?
I would say, and, anybody that's heard me play would definitely say that my piano playing is unique.
Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to make you. I see. I've perhaps set you up for self-deprecation here. I see.
Yes. No.
That's not at all what I meant. Your piano playing is lovely. No. It's absolutely lovely. I meant you. Unique and like genuinely just unique. Like, that's unique.
Yeah, you know, I'm sure there's influence, right?
Yeah.
From playing the organ that, you know.
I mean, certainly you've been playing piano for a long time now as well, so it's not like,
right?
Not like it was yesterday, of course. So.
Right.
So, is that is that sort of like the biggest expression of you know, musical output for you, or have you picked up other, you know, like, do you have a penny whistle laying around or guitar or stuff like that? What else do you do?
I do have a whistle,
mm-hmm.
and I have a Boron sitting here, which, you know, I have no idea how to use that thing.
Sometimes I wonder how many of us actually do. Maybe none of us do.
Yeah, it's just people that can really play the Boron. That's,
isn't that the coolest?
That amazes me. Yeah. You know, and
I'm just like a caveman with a stick and a rock when I pick one.
Right.
The gentle touch that a legit player has, and all the tones they get out of it and stuff. It's just awesome.
Right. Right. No. I would say that the vast part of my music experience, you know, as far as doing anything worth noting, would be probably piano or organ.
Yeah.
But the, you know, the pipes is something that, you know, I signed up on the dojo, and Andrew mm-hmm. Douglas, he rolls his eyes when you know, and
here's but Jeff,
you
know, again.
You just, yeah, right, right. but you just carry on, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. So do you remember one night that you and Tyler and I spent hours and hours in one of your back rooms, all of us scratching our heads trying to figure out how to get a treadmill out of the room?
That
do you remember that? It was years ago.
Very fond memories.
It was a great night. It was, but also, like, how ridiculous that three grown men couldn't figure out. Like, seriously, I don't remember exactly how long, but it was seriously hours. It was like, how did this thing get in here? How did we get it out? So I remember from that night, though, also seeing some really cool art, some paintings hanging on your walls. Now that later you told me your daughter had done. Do you and your wife also do visual art, and that's where she picked it up, or was that a surprise to you guys that, like, oh, we've got an artist in the family?
No, that was a total surprise. Mm. So my daughter is intellectually delayed. She has what they call a myelin deficiency.
Mm.
So the myelin sheath that are on the ends of the, you know, the nerves, have kind of deteriorated. And so she's like a, how would I describe it? Like a 31-year-old going on 12 or something like that, you know. She's fully functional, but she just has this real kind of childlike kind of thing to her that you know, it's very endearing for us.
Oh, and I'm sure, yeah.
You know, love her to death. So we received a phone call one day from the art teacher at Woods Cross High School, and he wanted to meet with us regarding our daughter.
Mm.
And I'm thinking, oh,
what's,
man,
she done?
Yeah, exactly, you know. And so we go down there, and he says, your daughter has this incredible ability for color.
Mm.
And he says, what she does is he would, like, draft out in pencil, you know, something for her.
Mm.
And then she would just start picking up the paints, and she would mix her own colors.
Oh, she wasn't just taking them from the tube, huh?
She would mix them. And, you know, and he said, I've never seen that, because once she picks it up, she doesn't stop. It's not like she looks back and, you know, studies the painting or anything like that. She just picks it up and just starts mixing and starts, you know, and doesn't do it until it's time to stop.
So it's kind of it's a flowy thing, and it's not like a premeditated thing.
Right. Interesting. Right. Absolutely. And so he says, you know, we've got this guy that's coming in who's, you know, one of these big artists that we've invited. And he's actually looked at her work and said that this is, you know, this is pretty amazing. And we're thinking, you know, at church on Sunday when she's doodling, you know, and then we're taking the stuff out and throwing it, tossing it in the trash.
Yeah, every Sunday, just systematically throwing her stuff away.
Right. And we're thinking, holy cow, you know, that could pay for the phone bill.
Right, and, yeah. You know? At this point in high school, it's like, how many decades of her like early work have we now just thrown out that could have been worth even more?
Yeah.
Those are the thoughts that would go through the parents of any art prodigy, right? Like,
absolutely.
Many silly doodles. Absolutely. How many times they get angry at them for drawing on the wall when I should have just put a frame around it, you know?
Yeah.
That's really interesting, Jeff, because like I do remember like it, I think part of it was that it felt like a series. In my memory, as we walked down the hall, it was like there were several of them, and so it was like there was more than just one, but they definitely were like attention grabbing, you know.
She had done, I want to say, close to 30 paintings, and they had it at the what would you call it, an art show that they had in Bountiful.
Mm-hmm.
And she sold out on her paintings, and they had her do some more. And of course, we thought we better, you know, buy them ourselves, you know, before, so that we can actually have a few. So,
have some memories.
Yeah, that's what you saw. Yeah,
gotcha. Well, that's super cool. So is the condition? Did you say is it called myelin?
Yeah, myelin.
Myelin.
Yeah, myelin deficiency. So the condition can go three ways. It can stay the same, it can get worse, or it can improve.
Mm-hmm.
And hers has basically just kind of stayed the same.
I see. So it's kind of like there was development and progress up to about the point where it is now, and it's kind of paused. It's not like,
yeah,
it's not like she'll
that's...
be a 60-year-old going on 20 at some point.
Right.
Gotcha.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah.
Gotcha. Well, that's really interesting. And also, like, you know, of course, like, there is added interest in some ways when, like, an artist is neurodivergent in some way that, like, it's like, oh, there's a different way of seeing the world, and it kind of gives you, like, maybe a little peek into that and stuff like that. But, you know, you don't want necessarily for, like, the art's only interest to be that, like, you don't want the reason the art is interesting to be her condition, of course, right? Like, the art is beautiful on its own, and I guess that's part of it, is that, like, I was like, Jeff, where did you get these paintings? Because, like, they were just cool paintings all on their own without having any idea who your daughter is. And it's also interesting to me, Jeff, that, like, why did they grab my attention when I'm severely colorblind? And so you wouldn't think that, like, interesting things with color would have really pulled my interest.
But yeah, that is.
But they sure did. I feel like there was a lot of contrast, though. Were they done often on, like, a black background? Was it, like, a lot of black and then the color popped out of that?
Yeah, I think that... they had matte around it, you know,
maybe,
and
that's why
I believe that
there.
A lot of the matte was black.
Yeah. Huh.
So.
Well, that's super cool, though. So you got music coming out of the family. You got visual art coming out of the family. What else does the Mann family do, like, together? You know, like, are you the kind of people who like to go hike around Red Rock, or do you like to what's the family stuff like?
So. My wife and kids love to drag me out and go hiking, and I try to find the flattest place to go.
The flattest thing you can call a hike.
Yeah, yeah. Right. And then, you know, if we can stop a few times on the hike, you know, if we go 200 feet... I think I'm doing pretty, you know, stealthy kind of stuff there.
I'm going to psychoanalyze you based on your answer, of course. But, you know, around here, you've got options are basically mountain or desert, right? Which one would you prefer in general when it comes to going out in the nature?
So we do cemetery.
You do cemetery. Well, there you go.
Yeah. No, actually, we've gone up. We've done some mountains.
Yeah.
A little bit, but again, like I say, few and far between,
mm-hmm.
and the flatter the better.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know. Yeah.
Oh, I hear you there. But do you get them back by dragging them out to every Scottish festival that you can?
Man, you've got me down.
I figured you have got that's got to be the case, right?
You know, and just to see the look of joy that comes across my wife's face.
But like on that note, have you convinced any of your kids at any point to pick up sticks or chanter?
My son was playing chanter for a while, mm-hmm. and when he got married, that kind of went away. My grandkids, they've been, you know, they'll come over and grab my chanter and, you know, play around on it.
But, yeah.
You know, I if they want to gravitate towards that, you know, I don't want to, because I remember when I was pushed playing organ,
mm-hmm.
and you know, it was just like a fight fest.
Yep.
Every day, you know, 15 minutes, you know, my face was red, I was sweating, I, you know,
yep,
let this, you know, horror be done. So yeah,
that's exactly what we're putting our kids through with piano right now, and that's why I'm similarly trying to be like somewhat cautious with the pipes and whistles and other stuff, because like I want them to be like fun options for my kids,
right.
Like I hope they'll like doing these things, and I do want them to do them, but if I'm already torturing them through one thing, you know, I don't want to create even more points of friction between us. You know,
right. Yeah.
Which it's also like the silliest torture to put one's child through, right? It's like, you're going to thank me later, you know? And it's, you know, costing me, how much is this costing me every month just to have my child, you know, like cry and scream at me, you know?
Man, that was a flashback.
Tell me it gets better, Jeff. Tell me it gets better.
I was hearing my mom right there for a minute.
Yeah,
you know?
You'll thank me when you're older. Now, you also, this is maybe a very trivial thing to ask you about, but it's one of the things that I do think is really cool. When I see you with your awesome walking stick, where did that drone walking stick come from? Did the Morals make that?
No.
Where did that come from? And maybe tell me about it, because this is radio after all. You know, maybe describe it a little bit
more. Right. So it's a walking stick. It looks like a cane,
mm-hmm.
and it has the head of a thistle. So this, we were over in Scotland. We were going to the Worlds, and Andrew Morrill was with me.
Was this when Wasatch went to compete, or was this just to spectate?
No, this was just Andrew and I, mm-hmm. Had gone 1 year. And Andrew wanted to stop off at a bagpipe shop.
Naturally.
And so we went over to Sinclair, the Sinclair shop. And when we walked in there, there was this glass case that had this exact same thing sitting in the case. Mm. And I'm like, holy cow, that is gorgeous. Mm. What is that? You know? And they said, well, this is what, so Alistair Sinclair had made this for his father. I believe that's how the story went.
Mm.
And what it is you can unscrew the top of the stick, and where, you know, where this top of this thistle, mm-hmm. thing is, and you get a blowpipe.
Oh, Jeff! Oh, this is so cool. I've seen really, really old illustrations of these things before. Like, they don't seem to exist anymore, but it seems like they used to be a thing. Carry on. Tell me more about it. Yeah.
And so at the bottom, you can unscrew the bottom, and then you've got a little practice gym.
Yeah, yeah.
And so what happened was his father was getting old. Alistair's father was getting older. His grandfather, I can't remember which one. And he used to go across the road over to the park, and he would practice.
Mm-hmm.
But what he would do is he would have his practice chanter in one underneath one arm, his music under the other arm, and a cane, you know, as he was going across. And so Alistair sat there and thought, huh, how do we, you know, and then this whole idea of making a practice chanter cane came up. And so, you know, I saw that thing sitting in that case and I said, man, I have to have one of those.
That is
you
so
know?
Cool, yeah.
And so, yeah.
That's the only thing cooler than a sword cane in my mind. Like, the only thing that...
right.
I would have said I want a sword cane, but now I want a practice chanter cane.
Yeah. Yeah, it was... It's a cool thing.
How do we get... So then did you have them make you one there at the Sinclair guys? Or how did you get a hold of one?
Yeah. So he made it for me and sent it over and...
So how do we get the morals to start making them, huh?
You know, that's a good idea, actually.
Come on.
I never thought about that.
I really want one. I think it's so cool. I saw an illustration once, Jeff, of one that somebody had made like a really long time ago. Like we're talking, you know, like pre-photos. You know, this is a really old illustration of one that somebody had made where it actually had two reed seats in it. And so one of the reeds, you know, went to your fingering, but the other one just played a little longer down the stick and there was a hole. So you had a little drone going too.
Wow. Wow. That is cool.
So come on, Ross, Andrew, let's do this. I want one. Yeah. You got one pre-sale already.
That's right. And, you know, we could probably take it over there and they could,
They could get the measurements. Look it over, get some ideas. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Good idea.
Mm. So, Jeff, when it comes to listening to bagpipes, other than live on the day of a competition, of course, who do you like to listen to? What pipe bands or trad groups or soloists, what do you like listening to?
I do really enjoy me some Simon Fraser.
Sure, absolutely.
I really do like them. You know, you can't... you can't go away from listening to Inverary with, you know, with anything but a smile. And then, you know, Field Marshal. I mean, I guess those are the main ones, of course.
Well, yeah. Solid listening for sure. If money were no object, what would be your go-to piping and drumming, you know, piece of kit or experience or, you know, what would you do if you had a blank check when it comes to, you know, bagpipes and stuff like that?
You know, one of the things that I really want is the Blair chanter.
Ooh, yeah, those seem cool.
That, you know, I saw them at Winter Storm, and I just, man, I'd love to get a Blair chanter. As far as pipes go,
Now, the morals are going to be offended if you don't say you want a set of their pipes, just you know, putting that out there.
And I do have a set of theirs.
Oh, okay, so we're covered there then, okay.
Yeah, we're covered there. Man, I just, I think that I'm going to have to plead the fifth on that one because I just know too many.
Yeah, you
know.
You don't want to upset any other makers. Yeah.
Yeah.
Understandable. Did you go to Winter Storm just this year?
I did. We had our Anapaba meeting and we typically will hold our Anapaba summit the same time as Winter Storm.
So that's you know, not to end this lovely talk on a boring note or anything, but like, what can you tell me about all of this work that you do to keep, you know, our associations existing and running? Like, do you only do it because nobody else is willing and you're a noble soul? Or have you found a way to find joy while doing it? Because my impression is that nobody else is willing.
James, have you known me to be a noble soul? Oh, my gosh. You know, Anapaba kind of came into its own, you know?
Mm.
Yeah. All we had to do is just get the presidents of all these associations together. And, you know, looking at commonality, looking at standardizing, looking at, you know, what is something that works here in North America that, you know, doesn't work, or something that works in Scotland but might not work as well over here in the States.
Right, what's unique about here?
Yeah. And I think that we learn, you know, there's no doubt that we learn so much from our counterpart, from the RSPBA and, mm-hmm. and Scotland and National Piping Center and all these people. We get so much from them and then try to, you know, fit it into our demographic.
Yeah.
And, but I think that this last meeting was very eye-opening. We had an incredible presentation from Michael Gray and Jim McGilvery.
Oh, yeah.
Gave an incredible presentation as well. But we're, I think, needing to refocus quite a bit on reaching out and you know, having some kind of outreach program.
Is that like to reach out to people who aren't pipers and drummers to get them into it?
Right.
I see.
Right. Because Michael had some data that showed that, you know, you wouldn't know it to look at it. But, you know, piping and drumming in North America has gone way down, way down.
In terms of numbers.
In terms of numbers.
We don't want to make anybody feel bad by saying it's in terms of quality, of course.
Oh, no,
might
no,
also
yeah,
be the case,
yeah,
who
yeah.
knows, right?
Yeah.
Did it start going down about the year I started to solo, Jeff? Was that the turning point?
No, actually, I think that, you know, people will acknowledge that some of the most innovative stuff in piping and drumming are coming out of North America.
We'd certainly like to think so, right?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, our numbers are going down. And so, you know, the thought of doing some kind of outreach in areas that you wouldn't normally go, you know, homeschool programs. Synagogues. We were talking about, you know, the Sikhs have a band out in, I believe it's up in the Toronto area.
Oh, really? You know,
if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
What Michael was telling us. And it's, you know, if we can get outreach going and start building up some of our numbers, you know, I think COVID really gave us a big hit.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, even some of the people that dropped off bands and things and decided to get into other things that they could actually do during COVID,
yeah.
You know, reaching out to them again and
get them back,
because,
right?
Yeah, absolutely.
That is interesting. Like, of course, I only, you know, I have blinders on outside of my own experience. And so, like, you know, I think to myself, like, well, I learned to play in a public high school program. And of course, that was great for me. And so I would naturally think to myself, let's get more public high school programs going, you know? And also, right. like, I think we're probably all, like, I hadn't even thought of it until you just mentioned it, but, like, I am very accustomed to hearing people talk about how their bands practice at the such and such Presbyterian church. That just seems to be, like, a very ubiquitous thing. And, like, so, like, it wouldn't have even entered my consciousness that, like, there are also homeschooling programs and charter schooling programs and other religious buildings that could host a band practice, you know? Like, oh, yeah, so maybe, man, it feels so similar to that closed mindset that I had about, like, who could be on the board for things, you know? That, like, what if I'm only casting my net in such a narrow space, you know? Like, how do we cast it wider?
Right. Mm. And you know, with that, again, you know, you're inviting culture and you know, different, you know, aisles of thought and ideas and
cool synergies and innovations will come from that.
Yeah.
It's absolutely. The Hegelian model, right?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Have a thesis and an antithesis and have them create a new synthesis.
Yeah.
Yeah. So is the future bright for piping in North America?
I think it is. Yeah. I really do because, you know, everybody, and in my thinking, everybody has a hero, right?
Yeah.
Be it a pipe band or a piper or drummer or, you know, somebody like that. And as long as these individuals are willing to help and again, like do outreach, mm-hmm. And become available. I think that people will always, you know, even if they're in awe of, you know, these people and they find out that, holy cow, these people are human. They're willing to help. Mm-hmm. They're, you know, as cool and good as they are, you know, you can actually talk to them and they'll talk back you know, share what they've got, share their knowledge and teach and instruct. And, you know, I do feel like the future is bright. Mm-hmm.